The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We have economic activity that's weak. We have financial firms that are closest to the central bank community in Japan and in Germany, which are being hurt, not helped by their policies. It's the backlash and the collapse of confidence that marks the tone and tenor of a real bear market low. And by the way, we never saw the behavioral backlash and the collapse in confidence in that 08-09 period. But I think we're likely to see it soon.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I was thinking about this because someone had made a comment about how debt really doesn't matter. And I want to talk about that in a minute. But do you remember the first time you borrowed? The first time you ever went into debt to have something? It's a really different feeling than when you've borrowed and borrowed and borrowed and you can't pay it back. But in the beginning, it's really almost magical. I remember when my wife and I got married. That was the first time we borrowed. I was 20 years old and we pulled the credit card out and bought something that we couldn't afford. And we went home with it and it felt great. And really, it was, you know, the argument, hey, it's only going to cost us this much more a month. You know, the old encyclopedia salesman, you know, could you give up a Pepsi a day for a month to own this particular book? But over time, it adds up.
Well, I do remember that experience, and it was not a positive one for me, because borrowing from my dad, I mean, not that he had usurious rates like a credit card, but he did expect to be paid back. I think it might have been for a skateboard. You know, he was willing to pay a part of it, but I had to pay a part of it back.
Did you sort of consider it a gift until you found out that you had to pay the money back?
Well, it felt really good to have it. But I really did not like paying it back. It made the whole experience sort of sour for me. And so, actually, I'm grateful for experiences like that. My first experience gambling was the same at age 12. You know, the fastest $20 ever spent in my life. Literally, blackjack table, 2 seconds, gone. And I'm thinking to myself, why? Why do people do this?
Well, and see, to continue the story, we borrowed again. And we borrowed again. I mean, this is right after getting back from our honeymoon. We had credit cards. I had never had a credit card before. My wife had. But you know where it ended? Actually, I hate to say it, several times in our young married life. It ended with us sitting at the table, crying, cutting credit cards up, realizing that we could never do it again. Now, what made me think of that was we just came out of a meeting where one of the associates that we have here was talking to someone and they said, you know, what is really $20 trillion in debt? What difference does it make? It's numbers on the computer. Have we really ever felt the effect of the debt?
I think this is where we do feel, for the first time in a long, long time, the effects of debt.
Yeah.
Because you've got Stanley Fischer, who's the vice CEO at the Federal Reserve, and he's saying, look, we've got low economic growth, and it's what he calls a structural low growth theory.
Right.
And he's got his explanation of why we're seeing these structural issues in the economy, why the monetary policy that's been put in play has had less effect than expected and anticipated.
Well, let's talk about the effect, okay? Because in the beginning, when the United States was a creditor nation, when they borrowed, there actually was GDP growth. You could measure actual growth beyond what was being borrowed, couldn't you?
Yeah, well, that's right. I was looking at an interesting chart last week, looking at sort of our all-in debt figures. This would be private, corporate, governmental. And you look at the total debt in the country, well over $60 trillion, $60
trillion. With a T.
Yeah. And it's, you know, better than 350% compared to our total economy.
Hmm.
And what's interesting is looking at this chart, the disconnect began, the gap began to widen starting in about 1971. 1971, of course, is when we lost our ties to gold, that anchor to our monetary system. And with the closing of the gold window, all of a sudden the gap begins to increase. The total debt that is allowed into the system really doesn't have a governor anymore. And so debt continues to increase, even while the economy is increasing.
Right. And
in that time frame, it's interesting because there was this sort of golden era. And I think this is really where the Keynesians hang their hat. At one time, a dollar in new debt drove $5 of GDP growth.
Almost made sense at that time.
Well, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you add to debt when you can expand the economy 5-1? I mean, it's actually a pretty reasonable thing to do for a certain period of time. And this was a recent study that showed these numbers that at present, a dollar in new debt actually reduces GDP by nearly the same amount. And the issue is this. When you have an economy which is creating growth, creating income, creating revenue, that revenue can then go to paying off the debt, at servicing the debt that exists.
Right.
But at a certain point, there's not enough growth to supplement or service the interest and principal payments on the debt, because the debt bubble has just gotten too big.
So let's say you're giving up the Pepsi. Okay, let's just go ahead and go back to that giving up a Pepsi. I can give up a Pepsi a day for a set of encyclopedias. I can't give up 400 Pepsis a day because I don't drink 400 Pepsis a day and I can't afford them anyway. And that's sort of what happens. You get to that point where you sit down with your wife crying, cutting the credit cards up. But this country hasn't faced that at this point. We've only experienced what you're talking about, which is a drop in the growth numbers to where we're actually shrinking at this point, based on debt.
That's right. So you've got Larry Summers with his secular stagnation thesis. You've got Fisher with his structural low growth theory. And they're trying to wrap their minds around something that's actually pretty simple. And it's like they didn't get the memo, or the memo that was sent out, you know, Keynesians didn't read it.
Right.
And it's this, the persistent intervention in the marketplace and the rampant debt accumulated through the decades, it's caught up with us. And that is the reason why the economy is not growing.
Right.
It can't under this kind of burden. When you look at total debt to GDP, it says it all. Secular stagnation is tied to a structural debt problem that's not being allowed to clear. What I mean by not being allowed to clear? Well, now you've got the central bank, which is afraid of the solvency of its member banks. Mm. Because guess what banks do? Banks loan out money. Loaning out money is what? Creating debt.
Right.
But to the bank, that debt, that loan into the system, is treated like an asset. For the system to clear, you have to get rid of a certain amount of debt, which means that you are destroying a certain amount of assets, which also means that you are impairing the balance sheet of those financial institutions. So you've got the central bank who is backing the play of your commercial banks and saying, we cannot allow there to be any correction in the value of the bank assets, right? Which are loans, which is debt.
When you say correction, you're talking about going down.
That's right. So you have an ebb and flow in the business cycle where at times there's an expansion in debt, and then there's a contraction, and then an expansion, and then a contraction. And that's the way a normal system works.
But you can't allow contraction these days.
Well, it's abnormal because the stakes are so high.
Yeah.
And to see some pocket of debt be cleared, in other words, be wiped out, and to eliminate that burden on the economy, they won't do it. They won't allow for it to happen because they're afraid of the unintended consequences into the derivatives market. They're afraid of who in the banking sector may go out of business and how that changes many things.
Well, and this is definitely not just a United States issue. Okay, what we saw with the global financial crisis is the United States went through the quantitative easing programs 1, 2, and 3. They lowered the interest rates. But actually, it's a global issue. We're seeing this growth slowing elsewhere. China, Europe, all over.
Right. When you're talking about global growth, global GDP has been suffering. And, you know, we saw this last week with the horrid trade data from China. Exports down 10% year on year. Imports down 1.9% year on year. And in that part of the world, it's the stuff of revolutions.
Sure.
No surprise then that in anticipation of a significant economic slowdown in China, you have a reinvigoration of Maoism.
Mm.
And this is just when Chinese capitalism was sort of emerging to save the day and show us a bright and brand new form of capitalism. Maybe they, with their command and control dynamics, could teach us something about capitalism. And lo and behold, we've got Mao reemerging. We've got him reemerging to save the day, and it's Xi Jinping almost wearing the mask of Mao, flexing his muscle and consolidating power.
Well, and what we have is a revisitation of what Carmen Reinhart talked about being a need to create a captive audience. Now, in China, the way they create a captive audience is a return of communism. But, you know, look at what's going on here in America. We have growing wealth inequality. And what we're seeing, we may not have a return of Maoism, but we certainly are having a return of either socialism or statism right on the election podium.
Well, and maybe you could classically say that the choices between the red shirts and the blue shirts are Socialist Party A and Socialist Party B. In this election, it's actually Statist Party A and Socialist Party B.
Right. We're not given a free market or a constitutional freedom choice. We're given a statist choice in Trump or a socialist choice in Hillary.
And what's interesting is there is a lot of banter about wealth inequality, and there is a lot of blame being laid at the feet of globalization. The challenge here is really to properly understand the cause, and on that basis, a proper remedy. And I think a remedy has to be sought because politics can and is moving to extremes. And so it needs to be addressed sooner than later. It's a topic we're going to explore as we move towards the end of the year, and as we get past the election in November. I want to explore again this notion of globalism versus globalization. I get some clear definitions, because again, the issue of wealth inequality is being blamed on globalization, but I think actually closer to the truth is the unmooring of our monetary system and what has developed as a consequence of that from 1971 to the present. But we'll get into that in future programs.
Well, let's just look actually at corporations here in America. You were talking about revenue, you know, nationally or worldwide, not being able to keep up with debt. Let's look at the stock market and look at how stocks are valued in relation to the revenues of companies, because revenues may not be growing when the equity prices are.
Well, we've talked about lots of metrics on the program. We've talked about price earnings multiples as one valuation metric. We've talked about, you know, price to book. We've talked about the 10-year rolling average of the price earnings ratio. We've talked about Tobin's Q and the replacement value of stocks, looking at buying them either at a discount or at a premium. Those are all different metrics of valuing equities. John Hussman, who I've quoted before, drew an interesting chart recently showing the S&P 500, the average price of the S&P 500 going back to 1986. And he's dividing that by revenue. So you've got a picture, again, of valuations for companies, another valuation metric using revenue generation and market price for the index.
Well, and just to make it simple, revenue generation is what is your income? Okay. For the guy who comes home every week with his paycheck or every 2 weeks with his paycheck, that's his revenue.
Well, that's right. So you look at things back in 1999 and things were very expensive. In fact, the most expensive they'd ever been on this metric. And then by the time we got to 2008, again, looking at the price of the S&P 500 relative to the revenues generated by those large companies, you now had valuations in the S&P 500 at levels never seen before.
Right, before the two great crashes of the last 20, 25 years.
Right. Now, it's interesting because we're at even more extreme levels today, looking at this particular ratio, than at any other time in stock market history. So again, looking at corporate revenues, we've had stock prices which have remained elevated over the last year, year and a half. At the same time, corporate revenues have been falling. And so the ratio is at all-time highs because of this. Again, we've stayed above 18,000 on the Dow, very healthy numbers on the S&P equally. And even though prices have remained high, revenues have been in decline. The ratio spikes on that basis.
Right.
So for most people, they look at price only. What we've said over and over again is that you've had five, coming up on six quarters of a decline in revenues, which is very, very, very significant. Revenues are a very important factor. And quite interestingly, they're not subject to the same chicanery that earnings are. When you look at how people report their earnings, are they using GAAP versus non-GAAP? That's generally accepted accounting principles. Or are they just kind of making it up and taking advantage of various write-offs and things that allow them to pretty up the pig, so to say? I like revenues because they do tell a pretty clean story.
Well, and you know, it's interesting, just the way you explained why debt affects us. You know, for the gentleman who said, what's $20 trillion in debt? What you pointed out was debt now creates a shrink of GDP. That would be considered revenue as well.
Well, that's right, because what we're talking about is the requirement of that additional debt to take future income and revenue to service it. So at one point, it did create more growth. Now it's actually requiring more in terms of revenue sucking, if you will, out of the economy. So it has a negative effect. Flabbergasting to me that academics don't see this.
But look at the stock prices, just exactly what you're saying. The Federal Reserve is keeping asset prices high. We know by whatever means that they do it, whether it's the plunge protection team or whether it's some other mechanism.
While corporate reality is showing up in revenues.
The revenues are dropping just like they are on, like we said, the comparison to debt side.
Yeah, IBM had their 18th decline in revenues, 18th consecutive quarter of declining revenues.
That's IBM. But as a whole, isn't it five straight quarters of declining revenues?
That's right. And I think as we move towards this next quarter, it'll be six.
So this brings up a question, Dave. Is there any normalization or exit for the Fed?
Nope.
The Fed's going to have to keep these asset prices high.
No.
Because everything else is shrinking.
That's right. No exit for the Fed. As much as everyone has hoped for normalization, you've got aggregate central bank accommodation globally. It's remained high. And it's vital. At least it's vital to the financial markets.
Mm.
It's become obvious that it's not vital to the economy, but it is vital to the financial markets. September came and went. You had Dudley in Boston and Stanley Fisher, who's a key player and an essential vote. They were unable to move the ball down the field. They said in September that there was the possibility for a rate hike.
Mm.
And look, it becomes more and more difficult to raise rates when
right.
corporate and Wall Street buddies call and complain about five quarters of sequential earnings in decline and with a sixth expected, which will match the longest earnings recession on record. Keep that in mind. The longest earnings recession on record. We have one more quarter of a decline in earnings.
Right.
And we'll have the longest earnings recession on record.
And add to that Hussman's chart, which is we also have the highest asset valuation. The stock prices are higher than any time in history based on those same revenues that have been declining.
Right. So earnings revenues in decline, prices still high. You remember that in January, stocks were tanking and the economic news was grim. The conversation was that the second half of the year would pull up GDP performance.
Oh, yeah,
for the
it was the glass half full. Hey, guys,
yep.
It'll be the second half of the year
right.
that'll do it.
That's right. And so corporations would see strong growth in the second half, and that hasn't happened. The fly in the ointment in January was the energy sector. So a part of the argument went that allow some stabilization to occur in the energy sector and earnings and revenues will recover. But that was supposed to be cleared out by the second half with energy companies coping a little bit better. Of course, we have the new reality of stabilized oil and gas revenues, stabilized at lower levels, and it's not in free fall, actually at much higher levels than we were in January, and yet we're still struggling.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see GDP soaring.
Right.
You're actually seeing many of your fourth quarter estimates coming down. The New York Fed among them. New York Fed took their third quarter estimates and lowered it to 2.2%. And they took their fourth quarter estimates and lowered them to 1.2%, the annualized numbers. So the year end won't be as strong as expected if those forecasts, in fact, from the New York Fed prove accurate.
Right.
Where are we at, in fact? We're back to the beginning of the year, which was 1.4 to 0.8, if you're talking about the GDP growth numbers. That's where we were in the first half of the year and why we were so worried, why the Fed was immediately, January, February, recanting its we're going to raise rates four times.
I think we should go back and think about that for a second. Let's go back.
That was the December 2015 prognostication, four rate hikes in 2016 because the economy's humming.
Because we're going to have growth. Okay, so it doesn't help that industrial production for August is sliding as well, right? So industry at this point is contracting along with revenues.
Well, right. So do we sneak in an interest rate hike towards the end of the year? I think clearly, we've talked about this in the commentary before, we're too close to the election to see anything right now. What happens in November? Is it a punitive message to Trump? Is it a supportive message to Clinton? You know, look, the challenge with raising rates is you've got industrial production for August, which did slide. You've had capacity utilization right around 75%. In other words, the industrial sector, think about this.
Right.
The industrial sector, it's not firing on all cylinders, as you would expect in a broad-based economic recovery.
Well, okay, but let's look at what the Fed's looking at. The Fed also said they're looking at jobs numbers, which, even though they use errant kinds of measures, they are improving.
Well, it just depends on what you're looking at. And this is where you see the Fed sort of living a double life. Because on the one hand, they're very positive about the job numbers. But the danger of a double life, this becomes obvious. If you're prognosticating on Fed policy and you're right. thinking, oh, well, look, they're going to raise rates because jobs have improved. You've got U6 down to 9.7%. U3 is hanging in right at around 5%. This is okay. We're near full employment. And yet, remember the Fed set up its own metrics for jobs,
right.
the labor market conditions index, and it continues to disappoint. So what is this exactly? The Fed is looking at one reality, making decisions on the basis of that reality, and then talking about a totally separate and false reality, and assuming that the general public is perfectly happy. Listening to the word spoken, it corresponds to U3-U6, all is well, let's move forward. Why aren't you moving forward, the general public asks.
Right, well, pay no attention to the positive numbers, which is really what they're saying. It used to be pay no attention to the negative numbers, but now any positive number causes the stock market to go down because people anticipate the potential for a Fed rate hike.
We live in an age of data dependence, and we've just redefined what it means to be quote-unquote data dependent. Just watch the Fed as they dance all around the data and do nothing.
Okay, so if the Federal Reserve is beginning to lose its effectiveness, which I say that without laughing purposely, okay, because they have lost their effectiveness, there is the other side of the equation, Dave. Anyone who's taken economics 101 and had been taught Keynesian economics, there are two factors in Keynesian economics. You have monetary theory, which is the Federal Reserve, but you also have government fiscal spending. We've talked about this before. Both parties, whether it's Hillary or Trump, are saying, look, we're going to spend more money. That's going to get us out of the problem.
Oh, yeah. So this is a debt issue. Adding to our nearly $20 trillion in debt, that is an issue. I mean, broadly speaking, the trend has been deterioration in fundamentals.
Right.
Even as the financial market pricing has remained very positive. So deterioration in one side, acceleration or stabilized levels at a very high level on the other.
But if they're spending more money, doesn't that create a larger fiscal deficit? We've already seen an increase in the fiscal deficit just the last few months.
Yes, we have. And I think that's a part of both the dangerous environment that we live in, but also the multiple opportunities that are opening up. Yes, we have a fiscal deficit, according to the Congressional Budget Office, that's higher by $152 billion than expected, than compared to last year. So that puts us at about $590 billion for this year. Remember, year-end for the U.S. Gov is September, so we've booked the year. $590 billion is done. And recall that the number does not include the financing needs for 2016, which are in that category of national debt. What did we add to the national debt this year? Oh, just $1.4 trillion for the year. So
we're going to hit 20 soon, aren't we?
That's right. Actually, it looks like Obama may just miss the $20 trillion mark as he exits stage left.
Missed it by that much.
Well, and we're at 19.6. I mean, right. Who knows? We still have a few days left, and this is political season. So, you know, the opportunity to spend, a couple $100 billion, that would be fun as you're sort of getting ready to leave the Oval Office. Would you enjoy that?
I told you about my first debt.
Well, curiously, both presidential candidates look at the increase in spending as a major objective. That's a major objective in the years ahead. And what happens to debt levels? What happens to annual deficits between 2017 and 2020?
I think they're going to shrink, Dave.
Oh, well, clearly, we're going to cut defense. We're going to cut infrastructure spending. We're definitely going to cut entitlements.
I'm being tongue-in-cheek, of course.
Yeah, I've joined you. Whether it is defense and infrastructure or your run-of-the-mill entitlement spending, you've got your traditional parties, Statist Party A, Socialist Party B, which the bottom line is they like to party on someone else's dime. And I think what we're leaving for our children's children is encumbrance and burden, and that bothers me.
Well, the new book that you're coming out with deals with legacy, the prioritizing the future generations instead of ignoring or indebting the future generations.
You can actually pre-order it if you're interested. If you go to davidmcilvaney.com.
davidmcilvaney.com, well, good.
But if you want to pre-order the book, it'll be here second week of November,
wow.
Hardback.
Good.
So I'm just glad it's like a 24-month gestation period and the baby's born. But, actually, there's some themes in there that do resonate with this particular issue.
Well, and I read the pre-reader copy, and, Dave, I know I work for you, so, a person would say, oh, well, he's just saying that. But I can tell you, my wife asked me after I finished it, she said, all right, now, Kevin, if you didn't know Dave, and you didn't know the family history, and you hadn't worked with Dave and his family for 30 years, would it be a book you would have been interested in? And I told her this morning at the breakfast table, I thought about it, because you've got a lot of personal stories in there that I myself can say, yes, I saw those actually happen, and you applied them to the philosophies and the things you're teaching in the book. And I told her at the breakfast table this morning, I said, I really thought about your question, and I'm being honest. Yeah, this is a book that I would have had on my shelf. If legacy for my kids was an area of interest, which it should have been. You know, I mean, that would have been something, if I hadn't have known you, that would have been an interesting concept. I would have read the book, and there were so many things, and I'd like to talk about it as we go on through the commentaries. Just a piece here or a piece there, some of the things that people can learn about how to create legacy thinking where you're actually thinking positively forward instead of negatively forward about your family.
I think one of the key elements of the book is that legacy is not something that you are going to leave, but right. something that you're creating every day, which is, I mean, when I think of this
it's
issue.
An activity.
It is.
It's a verb.
And it's something that you're doing actively right now.
Right.
It just depends on what kind of legacy you want to leave. And you're either giving some thought, you're either being intentional about it.
Right.
That's the title of the book, or you're not. And it's what makes the current policies so irksome to me, because you look and you say, how within the DC Beltway can they rationalize leaving financial burdens instead of blessings?
Right.
And I mean, I think actually the bond market's beginning to smell a brewing crisis. You've got long rates, which are on the move up. And right now we should spend some time considering what is the message embedded in the action of the bond market, because it's telling you that there is today a minor revolt, and it could turn into a full-blown revolution, as in return of the bond vigilantes, you know, assuming that the Fed doesn't redouble its efforts and introduce QE4 shortly.
Well, and Dave, I was thinking about something. You said something in a meeting recently, which is absolutely true. We love what we do here. I love what I've done the last three decades here, because I can take paper assets that are devaluing and I can turn them into gold and send somebody gold. But you made a great point. If we were on a gold standard, and if we were on fair and right trading methods, we really wouldn't have a job. There wouldn't be a need for me. But let me translate that to the central bankers for a moment. The central bankers, Janet Yellen, Ben Bernanke, going back to Alan Greenspan, they would be out of a job. They would be out of a job if they didn't need to stabilize things based on this debt.
Now, it's interesting. We do exist because of the extreme dysfunction in the economy and in the financial markets today.
Exactly. If cancer didn't exist, you wouldn't need a doctor to cure cancer.
Right. And gold represents something of a financial insurance policy.
Right.
Which, in a world of safety or where you have sound money, actually, there is sort of a self-correcting mechanism within the economy, which you don't have today. And you see that going back to that debt to GDP figure and the numbers dating to 71, the gap between those two lines,
right.
you know, where debt continues to rise exponentially. And yes, the size of our economy is moving up, but the gap between those two lines grows and grows and grows and grows and grows.
But here is the illusion, Dave. Okay, it's grown. We haven't really felt it. It's boiling the frog slowly. We haven't truly felt it. The Federal Reserve, if you think about it, what gold used to do for people and still does for people who understand, which is allow for stability, the Federal Reserve has become the stabilizer.
Well, so here's what they've stabilized. They're supposed to be in the business of price stabilization.
Right.
They're actually in the business of perception stabilization.
Right.
Right. So the danger in the marketplace is one of disillusionment and disorientation.
Right.
I say that because when individuals feel that they've been led down the primrose path and then they confront a much harsher reality than expected, you can reasonably anticipate behavioral backlash.
That has not happened yet, Dave.
No. The central banks have positioned globally, actually, and they've advertised this, that their actions are the source and cause of the recovery, not a source and cause of the problem which has been building structurally over 30 or 40 years.
We're the central bankers. We're here to help.
Yet we have economic activity that's weak. We have financial firms that are closest to the central bank community in Japan and in Germany, which are being hurt, not helped by their policies. And again, I'm thinking specifically of those affected by zero and negative rates. It's the backlash and the collapse of confidence that marks the tone and tenor of a real bear market low. And by the way, we never saw that. We never saw the behavioral backlash and the collapse in confidence in that 08-09 period. But I think we're likely to see it soon.
Well, all right. There's another illusion, Dave. There's another illusion that there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines. We've even talked about it, that is waiting to go into the market. Now, Jim Deeds pointed something out last week, and I love it when we talk to Jim Deeds, because he remembers the good old days where you could measure risk. you could measure opportunity, and you could take your pick. But there's a lot of money flowing, you've brought this out before too, into either passive investments where you just put your money in, you forget about it. That can be a money market or it can be an index. But really, let's talk about those indexes for a moment, because an index isn't really a true investment. An index actually is a betting line on a true investment, is it not?
Indexes and index funds serve a valuable purpose for giving people exposure to a particular asset class. But it's an interesting mechanism that takes place when you're buying an index,
right,
particularly because the indexes, the vast majority of them, whether it's the NASDAQ, NASDAQ 100, S&P 500, if you're looking at the New York Stock Exchange in aggregate, the Russell 2000, these indexes and more are capitalization weighted. And so basically, you have the largest companies, which have the greatest representation in the index,
right,
which means that when someone buys the index, there's even larger purchasing of the largest companies in that index.
The ratios don't change. In other words, they're getting a chunk of a certain amount of companies, but the companies with the highest capitalization are going to be the ones that represent the largest part of that index. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Well, and then it just compounds on itself. So you've got the indexes, which have driven this trend. Fund managers are tending to exaggerate this trend of where the money flows. Individual investors using the indexes are along for the ride, and it's the cap weighting nature that exaggerates the buying in companies within the index.
So companies like Apple and some of the bigger companies, they may be growing not based on revenue, not based on performance, but based on how many people are buying an index that buys them.
Well, that's exactly right. So this is what you're saying. Purchases are not made selectively on the basis of the merits of a company.
Right.
The fundamentals and growth prospects of a company, but on the basis of an existing position in the index. So think about this. The top five market cap stocks today are Apple, Google, which is now called Alphabet, Microsoft, Amazon, and Facebook. These five companies have a value of $2.35 trillion. So I mean, just think about this. You've got indiscriminate buying in index funds, and we know that there's massive purchases which are then made of these five companies, and they're made not on a valuation basis, but on the pre-existing position within the index. They see massive purchasing today, and I want to underscore a key word here. It's indiscriminate. It's indiscriminate. To discriminate means to have a reason to choose or not to choose. Like, what is your reasoning process behind saying yes or no to this or that?
Right.
This is indiscriminate. You're getting Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook because of their positions in the indexes.
Well, let me flip the coin then, because something that's purchased is always someday sold. What happens? Is it indiscriminately sold as well?
That's correct. That's correct. So if buying today is selling tomorrow, you're assuming that there are always ready buyers on the other side. We've discussed the myth of liquidity before and how in an up market, you assume that you can always get out. In a down market, you typically can get out, but it's at a price.
Right.
So if you don't mind getting skinned alive, no problem. Once everyone owns a particular asset and no one is left to make additional purchases, the question is who drives the price higher?
Right.
And so, I mean, this is Larry Summers' prophecy. I hear him echoing down the streets in New York, down Wall Street and Broad Street. Maybe it's the government who steps in and is the buyer of last resort and keeps on driving prices higher.
A little like Japan.
But here's the thing, just point and counterpoint. Even if Summers and that idea of the Japanese government stepping in and buying index funds to support the stock market, even if that is an action that's taken, look, you've had help from the plunge protection team back in the period of 2000. And when stocks were collapsing in 2008, it wasn't like all of a sudden the plunge protection team hung their head low, their tail was between their legs, and they hid under their desks and just said, oh, we don't have anything to do today. Well, I guess we'll just wait until tomorrow. No, they were active in the market all the way down, which says something. You couldn't stop the train from rolling down the tracks at high speed.
Right.
Shares of the most popular and crowded companies at that time, both in 2000 and 2008, they ended up being down 50 to 85%.
Even with the plunge protection team and the government directly intervening.
That's right. Now, you look at companies like Cisco, one of the high flyers of the era. Fred Hickey points out that, look, Cisco's still down 72% from its peak valuation. Intel is only slightly better. It is still down 65% from its peak valuation. So, as Fred Hickey notes, It's getting crowded again.
Let's talk about that. It's getting crowded again. In the trading vernacular, when everybody's going one direction, either buying or selling, that's called a crowded trade.
Right. So, I mean, you just have to let that sink in. You have five companies with a market capitalization of nearly $2.5 trillion. That is unbelievable. Five companies that have the market capitalization that's larger than many of the world's total stock markets.
And they're being indiscriminately purchased in these huge index movements.
Yes, yes, that's what I'm saying, is that the passive index investor is involved in indiscriminate buying today, driving up the prices and valuations of these kinds of companies. And that passive index investor selling tomorrow sells indiscriminately in the context of panic. And how do the mighty fall?
Yeah.
This is how the mighty fall. They got to levels that were unwarranted, unmerited, and they also get to levels when they sell off that are unwarranted and unmerited. This is the nature of market extremes. It's crazy at both ends. It's irrationally exuberant on the upside. It's irrationally panic-driven and fearful on the downside. And we are, as Fred Hickey says, getting to that point of being crowded again.
And we talk about creating a captive audience. Carmen Reinhart talked about that as well. How do you create a captive audience? Well, one of the key ways is you do it through regulation, or you do it through control of the media. Okay, control what's coming out, and you can control the people for a certain period of time. But, you know, look at these email dumps that are coming out right now. You were talking about how do the mighty fall. The mighty may just fall when you don't have one of the three top networks actually giving you the news.
One other thing before we move to politics,
yeah,
because this is one of the changes of the guard and people don't know it. April of 2017, doesn't matter which party gets elected, honestly. Doesn't matter, because there's things in the work. Department of Labor has put in motion some things that come into play April of 2017. And basically, it looks at compensation for asset managers, brokers, insurance salesmen, and whatnot. And do you know what we're going to inadvertently move to? A whole world of passive investing, where professionals and advisors are taken out of the equation completely, completely. It's very interesting, because it's almost like, you know, we've just gone through 8 years where, you know, if you're blindfolded and throwing a dart at the newspaper, any stock you bought would have gone up. Why? Well, because all boats rise with a rising tide. That's the nature of excess money printing and asset price inflation, right? So it didn't take talent in the last 8 years to make money in the stock.
But there's regulation coming out that penalizes someone from picking and choosing and telling their clients what to pick and choose.
What it does is it says, look, we haven't needed talent the last 8 years. Let's just face it, we don't need talent at all. And so basically, one of the transitions which is afoot is that the talent pool simply goes away. And about the time that old saw of just invest in an index fund and the market's going to do you favors, when that fails and fails miserably, guess what? The compensation for professional advice and investment is going away.
Right. So the Jim Deeds style of position trading, finding the best opportunity and sharing that with your clients, that's going away.
Well, here's the rationale. Did you make money on that transaction? You recommended something to your client.
Mr. Deeds, did you own that yourself?
So you had a motive to own that and you made money. Yeah. Well, clearly, then you should not have made that advice.
You should have just been buying an index fund, which indiscriminately buys the largest capitalization.
You realize that Deeds existed in a world where you could charge 2% for a stock transaction.
Right.
And today, you've got Vanguard index funds, which charge less than 25 basis points, right? And so, the way that Vanguard is lobbying the Department of Labor is to say, we don't want any competition.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be the only game in town, and we're willing to do it for 2 basis points or for nothing, and we're capturing the whole market. And again, that works in a world that allows for autopilot. But
yeah,
we've addressed this in past conversations. We're moving into a very tumultuous period of time where the last thing you want is to be on autopilot.
You know, Chuck Yeager, the first man to break the sound barrier, was on the board when they analyzed the Challenger disaster back in the 80s. And Chuck Yeager came from a day and age when the pilot who got into the plane, when he flew that X-1, he knew every piece. He said, a pilot should be able to take the plane apart and put it back together. I'm a pilot. You've flown planes. we know that there's a walk around on that plane. You do a pre-flight for a reason. And what he pointed out was this, the complexity of the Challenger, the space shuttle program, had exceeded the ability of any one person being an expert on the whole thing. It seems to me like what we're doing is we're building a complexity into this system through these index funds, through passive investing, where you have no experts left. And so when the selling does begin and people start panicking, not only do you not have anyone to buy, you don't have any experts out there that are even allowed to recommend buying opportunities when they exist.
Well, see, we have academics, but no experts, and there is a difference.
So you're killing the liquidity of the market, Dave.
Oh, well, you are. So you mentioned Jaeger. I forgot to tell you last week that I was able to spend some time with two young guys, the grandkids of the man who engineered the Saturn V rocket.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Wow. And he grew up in South Dakota on a farm and just tinkered with things on the farm, built things constantly. And he knew every piece of the Saturn V rocket. And he told his kids and his grandkids, if you don't understand it, don't do it.
Dave, I see where you're going on this. I mean, honestly, when you eliminate the experts, when you eliminate the people who can come in and actually do the tinkering, and in this particular case, Jim Deeds was a great example of someone who's now being eliminated by the academics. All of this seems to be in the name of managing the perception and the economy from the top down.
Well, and I have to be honest, the distinction here is between experts and academics. And only rarely is there an academic that is also an expert in the sense that they have enough real world experience to matter.
Right.
I mean, when you talk about a market practitioner is not someone who, like a brain in a vat, has sat in the ivory tower and written white papers all their lives.
Right.
That person may have tremendous value to add, but it needs to be taken with a grain of salt, because how do those theories actually work in practice? Mm. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is where an expert is someone with direct experience. I like a guy who builds a rocket who knows how to take apart a John Deere tractor.
Right.
I don't like a guy who builds a rocket who's only worked on a computer and with simulations.
Well, and Chuck Yeager said, look, you know, if a pilot could have actually done a walk around on that Challenger and had the things done the way they were done in the past, he could have said, look, it's too cold to fly. Those O-rings are too tight.
You know, politicians, you're mentioning kind of the new reality. And I think to transition, you have the ninth iteration this last week of the Podesta emails,
right,
which have been released
this
by WikiLeaks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think this is very important. It's a new reality, and it frankly is of greater importance than the Arab Spring, because politicians have never been more vulnerable, and in the future, they may actually have to embrace transparency. And that represents a radical shift for politicians, not only here in the United States, but overseas, to realize that actually they could be held accountable for everything that they say and do, because their private lives, the private expressions of their mind, held in confidence between coworkers and in the food chain politically, it all of a sudden is wide open.
Well, let me ask you, do you really think they're going to adapt that way and embrace transparency? Or do you think they're going to do what Wall Street's doing, and that is regulate away everything that's a distraction?
Well, I think that's an interesting point, because while nothing is private, it's very fascinating to watch how the political landscape is being affected by revelation after revelation of slime. And I'll be honest, this has nothing to do with Republicans or Democrats. In this case, maybe Podesta has to do with Democrats, but there's just as much slime. Remember that for every email that's revealed from Podesta's inbox or outbox, it can be revealed on anyone and everyone anywhere in the world.
Well, and that's right? What makes me think, you know, my son for years has told me, Dad, the internet is the Wild West right now. Enjoy it. This is when it's free. Information can flow for free. But there's no way that the powers that be can leave it in that state.
Well, that's right. We need to revisit the Nazli Shoukry interview. It was either December 2014 or December 2015. You've got to revisit and listen to that. The
right.
Interview, what's up for consideration is that the next administration will react to WikiLeaks, will react to Anonymous.
Right.
You know, Anonymous is saying that they can release the 33,000 deleted emails at any time. Just boom, they already have them. That is power. That is power that the political class is not used to dealing with.
They're going to try to protect themselves in the name of protecting us.
Right. So how do they create an internet with Teflon or bulletproofing for government.
Right.
I mean, maybe that's, you know, if you're online, it allows for access from hackers. So you look at the offline versions, the intranet instead of internet, and selectively cut services. You know, maybe that's a part of the answer. I don't know. But the interview with Shukri was really good.
Well, there's a question that has to be asked continually. Who controls the internet?
That's a very important question. And while governments are clamoring to control, it's worth noting that there is a revolution that's brewing. And the revolution is brewing because all of a sudden the mainstream media has lost its voice. And they've lost their voice to the wild, wild west, which is the internet.
Well, okay. And this brings me back to what I was talking about this morning. Also, my wife had Good Morning America on, okay? And they were talking about Trump. And, you know, the media, whether you like Trump or whether you like Hillary, or I don't care, you can definitely see the media where they lean. And you had George Stephanopoulos asking questions. And of course, they brought Cokie Roberts on for an objective analysis of what was going on with Trump. And I looked at my wife and I said, you know, okay, it doesn't matter who you're going to vote for. I can tell you right now, Cokie Roberts does not bring an objective analysis. And George Stephanopoulos worked for the Clinton administration back in the 90s.
I was listening to a fundraising program for National Public Radio. And it was funny because the NPR said, you know, bringing objective news and analysis for years and years and years.
Oh, right.
You know, and I'm thinking, right, because their view of fair appraisal is on the left, they have Pacifica Radio.
Yeah.
And on the right, they have your regular NPR reporting. And that's their version of conservative reporting, fair and balanced.
But politicians are losing their control through the internet. They don't have that same control unless you watch Good Morning America.
That's the point. That's the point, is that politicians are losing their ability to control the narrative,
right,
via the media. And so informational access and dissemination via the internet, it's eclipsing the relevance of the mainstream media. Today, the news outlets don't report after investigative inquiry. They don't. You're talking about a team of producers which analyze blogs. They look at headlines which someone else has put up to see what's trending. And on a last minute basis, they bring in experts to comment on popular trending themes.
Right.
But the main point is that internet communications have circumvented the normal information channels and have placed a few tech companies in a position of sort of transnational power, never imagined by the governing class, never imagined by the political
class. Right, there are no borders with the internet. You can have companies like Google that actually represent probably far more power than almost any nation state in the world, and they have no borders.
That's
there is
right.
No nationality. There's no national anthem.
They may have headquarters in the United States, but the companies are global. The interactions are transnational. The control of these companies, this is a real challenge. Look, I'm not advocating control.
Right.
I'm just suggesting that just as Twitter has been a powerful tool in the hands of Donald Trump, look, how much time he spent doing that as opposed to creating ads and spending millions and millions and millions on ads. This is actually quite funny. Media giants are suffering catastrophic income loss. They had expected major revenue from the Republican Party, and the Republicans aren't spending hardly anything at all.
Well, and look what Trump's doing. Virtually no mainline media whatsoever. The mainline media has turned against him, yet he has an amazing appeal based on internet information.
Right. So I'm suggesting that just as Twitter has been a powerful tool in the hands of Trump, social media has become a dominant factor in the campaign as a tool that can be taken. That tool can be taken from someone and abused as well. So Trump's use of the internet would suggest that he knows how powerful it has become in the making and remaking of the political landscape. And it's not a tool you leave unguarded or open for opposition to use.
Mm-hmm.
So control, this is a very relevant issue. We get past the November election. Who has control? How will it be exercised? The next few years, you can expect a big sheriff to step in and try to bring law and order to the wild, wild west of the internet. And I frankly don't mind the wild west. We've seen a second information revolution occur.
Right. Okay. So the first revolution was Gutenberg, right? The Gutenberg press?
Well, fast forward. I'm thinking of a shift in the means of communication.
Okay. So the internet itself.
Now we see the changes that come from dissemination of privileged information and the consequences of an open architecture where the whole world knows more than you hoped it would about, let's see, what would make its way into private emails, internecine conflict, policy priorities, backstabbing. I mean, it's like if you can imagine playing cards in a room full of mirrors, right? there really is nothing close to the vest anymore.
Right.
And it makes me wonder if politicians simply accept this as progress or try to prove, and then this is, I think, more likely what's going to happen, try to prove a level of vulnerability and risk on that basis and legislate and control the internet via fear.
Right. Well, and we're only talking about political things, Dave. You remember that Ashley Madison thing that happened about a year ago where all of a sudden 30 million guys who thought that they had a little secret.
Oh, no.
It wasn't a secret anymore.
It's not a secret anymore.
You know, in one respect, it's actually good that people not have secrets like that.
No, I agree on that point. But what I'm afraid of is the equivalent of a fairness doctrine coming into play.
Oh, I hear you.
Where all of a sudden, you know, fair and even reporting, I can't say a comment positive or negative about anything without having the opposite view equally represented by someone who represents the other side. I mean, we could take an hour commentary and turn it into a 5-hour commentary by having caveats and sort of the balanced perspective. I think we offer a fairly balanced perspective. We have our opinions right. And our views. But again, the fairness doctrine would require just sort of a tit for tat. I mean, everything that's said is balanced and measured with someone else saying the exact opposite.
Well, let's return to finance just for a moment, Dave, because this Wells Fargo thing has just been a complete mess.
Oh, speaking of dirty laundry.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the Ashley Madison of finance. Buffett, you'd think that he's either suffered a stroke or has laryngitis. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he's been awfully quiet. He's been awfully quiet on the Wells Fargo business. And it's interesting because he speaks through a bullhorn when it's the ethics dealing with someone else or something else.
Right. But because he's related to this.
He does the same thing with taxes. Hmm. As long as it's someone else's money, he's always willing to advocate taxing more of it. When right. it's his own money, he's one of the most efficient. I mean, he is the Donald Trump of the Democratic Party
right.
terms of finding tax-efficient means of managing Berkshire Hathaway. It's brilliant on the one hand. It's just irksome because it's disingenuous on the other. So, yeah, there is Wells Fargo, the business of Wells Fargo. Why has he been so quiet?
Right. Well, I want to address something, Dave, that honestly, I don't have a full feel of right now. You know, I enjoy the fact that the internet can give us a lot of information, but sometimes it's so unfiltered, it can be spectacular on both sides of the coin.
And spectacularly unhelpful and untrue.
Exactly. So I want to bring up Russia here for a moment, because things are happening in Russia and Syria, but there are internet avenues right now that are making us think that we're going to have a nuclear war sometime this week. I think it can be overstated sometimes, and this is where we have to have discernment. And I'm using a word right now that has a tremendous amount of power, but we have to have wisdom and discernment even when we're reading a message that reinforces what we already believe. Now, I believe that there's an issue in Syria. I also believe that it's going to get worse. But I think we have to be very careful and analyze the situation and say, okay, what is really happening? We know that Russia ordered all of its officials to fly home relatives abroad, according to a United Kingdom paper. But how close are we to, let's say, World War III?
Right. Well, between the yes and the no is the maybe. And so, you know, there's lots of things that are possible. And this is one of those variables that you should keep track of, you should look at.
But there is saber rattling.
A huge amount of saber rattling. And I think when Russia orders their officials to fly relatives home who are living abroad, that according to the UK's paper, the Daily Mail, maybe it's saber rattling, maybe it's more than saber rattling.
Right.
We know that tensions peaked over the weekend. We know that last week the RAF was given a green light to shoot down Russian jets in Syria.
Which would be an act of war.
True. So, I mean, there's things that you say, well, is it going to happen? Yes. No.
Right.
I say between the yes and the no is the maybe. There is the possibility. Honestly, let's look at the context. Syria may go down in modern statecraft as one of the greatest disasters of our time.
Right.
And that to me is really an issue. By not adequately responding,
right.
The Obama administration has contributed to a regional destabilization, Middle Eastern destabilization, European destabilization that counts over 300,000 people dead, and a refugee crisis, which is now driving European politicians to the wall. You realize that a well-entrenched political party headed by Angela Merkel is now in a fight for survival in large part because of an immigration issue. Think about that. The general sentiment on immigration in the last 3 years has changed dramatically. And right smack dab in the middle of it is a response to Syria and ISIS, both of which have remained front page items for all the world to consider.
Well, and so whether we call it xenophobia, whether we call it immigration, whether we call it just plain old raw fear. That's actually the motivation, Dave. There's raw fear, and actually some of it's warranted.
The unintended consequences are that there is a growing concern over immigration here in the United States. There's a growing concern over immigration in Europe. There's a growing concern over immigration everywhere that is fear-based. And it's at a fear-based level that we haven't seen in generations. Again, future weeks, not today, but I want to discuss and define globalization and globalism. I want to contrast the two. And in preview, I think it's enough to say that anti-globalization, that theme, is completely consistent with an immigration and refugee concern,
right,
with hyper-intervention from central banks, and with the consequences of a growing wealth gap that ties directly to central bank activism. What we may be witness to is a less than rational period of torches and pitchforks. So if it's torches and pitchforks in the future representing popular discontent, we need to get very clear on the definitions and understanding of globalization versus globalism.
Mm-hmm.
And as we mentioned earlier, I mean, we have the means of disseminating ideas and views through channels that government has not yet clamped down on. That's a story for the next 4 years. I think we'll see that change to some degree before we have that discussion. November and beyond, both in terms of the change of who controls what on the internet and globalization and globalism. Please go back to December's interview with Najlee Shukri. It's critical.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.